Leaders create more leaders. You may have heard this before. It's one of the core values of the legendary New Zealand All Blacks rugby team, which is the winningest sports team in the world. It's not just a value, though, for them. It's a system. It's a way of operating through the leadership council that they run. The All Blacks, they get it, okay? They understand how to develop leadership. One of the biggest misconceptions about leadership development is that it can be done through some sort of training program or curriculum. Over the last decade, though, we've had extensive research in the business world from Harvard Business School and some other Ivy League schools that has proven this. What does work, though? The research says there's actually four critical components to developing leaders, right? The first is experiential learning. People need to have experiences actually leading. Number two, personal development, in particular, developing emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence is so critical for leaders. Number three, developing a leadership system, not just the individual, not just focusing on developing each individual. We got to have a system to develop leaders over time. And lastly, the fourth thing is that coaches need to act like Sherpas or guides. They don't need to act like leadership experts. So these are some great guiding principles, but what does that actually look like in action? Well, today we're excited to have Adrian Scheibels on the podcast, who is the head women's basketball coach at Bowdoin College in Maine. They've had multiple Final Four appearances and two runners-up in the last few years for the NCAA Division III National Championship. But really what sparked my interest in her as a coach was an article that I read about her exceptional performance in developing the leadership of her players and the player-led culture that she's established. In today's episode, she's going to share with us a bunch of practical ideas for us to develop leaders and build that player-led culture. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast, brought to you by Thrive on Challenge. I'm JP Nurbin, joined by my friend and co-host Nate Sanderson. Each week, in about 30 minutes, we discuss important principles and strategies of transformational leadership. At Thrive on Challenge, we help coaches to raise the standards and strengthen the relationships in their program because we know this type of culture produces better leaders, better people, and better results. To learn more about how we can help you, go to thriveonchallenge.com, where you can also subscribe to our weekly newsletter and get the coaching notes to every episode of this podcast. Coaches, if you're frustrated by a lack of leadership on your team, you aren't going to just appreciate this episode, but you could likely benefit from the training course I've just released on CoachTube, the Captain's Council, the system to develop leaders, connect your team, and build a player-led culture. There's a link to the course and a limited time discount in the details of this episode, so be sure to check it out today. Adrian, thanks for coming on the podcast today. We're really excited to dive into the ways that you develop leaders within your program. But before we get into that, I thought you could share a little bit with us about how you got into coaching and particularly how you started coaching in Maine at Bowdoin College. When I think of basketball hotspots, I definitely don't think of Maine, or that's not the first place that comes to mind. But you've had a lot of success at the national level and you've been running a program all the way up in Maine.
Yeah, I grew up in Maine on a dairy farm about an hour and a half from here. And so, you know, just was looking for a way to get the family back to Maine, closer to my large, very large family. And I was at Swarthmore College, and so for 9 years, and had some success there and loved it there. But when my husband had an opportunity to grab a job here in Maine, we decided to come home. And we worked at a boarding school for a few years before the Bowdoin position opened and presented that opportunity. So I was very fortunate to get back in college coaching and find such a great fit.
Well, we're going to get into some of your coaching practices here in just a bit, but I'm a little bit curious about your playing experience. In the article that we'll link for our listeners in the podcast notes, you talked a little bit about how just the impact that had in your high school experience. And I guess I'm reading between the lines a little bit, but a lot of the things that you talked about kind of parallel in the experience that you're trying to create for some of your players. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about the impact that your high school experience had that kind of led you into doing what you're doing today.
Yeah, my high school experience was, I was very fortunate, especially now that I have children and they're playing sports. I was fortunate to land in a community where we had a an amazing high school basketball program with a coaching staff who was incredibly dedicated and created such a positive team culture. We had a great tradition of success at Mountview High School in this rural part of Maine. And in a lot of ways, it was like growing up in Iowa. I imagine it was, you know, when the tournaments rolled around, it was the school bus would take off for the Bangor Auditorium, and there'd be a line of cars behind the bus. The towns, 11 towns in our school district would all shut down. And everyone came to watch the high school players compete, whether boys or girls. And there was a following for both programs, which was incredibly special, I think. So I was definitely an awkward youth who lacked confidence. And so when the high school basketball coach approached me in the hallway in eighth grade and asked me to come out for the team, I'm imagining it's because I was tall. I was very fortunate. I mean, if he hadn't done that, I think my life would have turned out quite differently. And when I started competing at sports, it just not only presented me with a tribe of people who I related to and felt comfortable with, but it just fed my confidence, and my confidence grew. And so I owe my coaches so much for that experience. That was part of why I wanted to get into coaching when I started playing college ball at Bates College. And had my first female coach. Actually, it occurred to me, hey, I could give back in a way that she gave back to me, but also my high school coaches gave me all those qualities that have just made me the person and the professional that I am today.
And when it comes to how you run your program, would you say that has a significant impact on what you're trying to do and trying to create at Bowden?
Yes, for sure. Definitely trying to, you know, instill confidence in the student athletes, but also, you know, provide them with space and opportunity to grow and develop as leaders, and be able to leave our college fully equipped to go out to the working world and soar. So I think that's what really, I mean, I love the sport, obviously. I love X's and O's, but more than that, I feel like I really, you know, get a lot of satisfaction from developing relationships with student athletes and watching them grow and develop and go out into the world and do just amazing things.
Well, I think a lot of us as coaches, we say that's what we aspire to do, but you actually have an incredible record of accomplishing that. When I was reading up a little bit about you, I learned that I think it's 9 of your players or former assistant coaches are now coaches at other programs, largely head coaches. I don't know if I'm right exactly on the number on that of 9, but it's somewhere around that, which kind of made me think of that mantra that the New Zealand All Blacks have, which is that leaders create more leaders. And here you are as the leader of Bowden College and that program, but you are creating more leaders out there. How does that happen? How do you create this other tribe of coaches where they're going out there and they're running their own programs as well?
I think it starts with our recruiting process. One of our 4 team values, we look for women who have a passion for the game, a passion to compete. And so I think, you know, once we get those women into our program, and we have a shared leadership model at Bowden, so we give them a lot of opportunity to and ownership over the program and opportunity to lead and develop as leaders. And so I think that combination of working with people who are super passionate about the game. You know, obviously we attract the kind of student athlete who really wants to grow and develop as a leader, just given the nature of our model that we have. And so I think that's why we've had a lot of women go into the game and into coaching, which is fantastic. And unfortunately I have to compete against a lot of them in our league, which is sometimes challenging, but no, it's wonderful.
Well, one of the words that comes up over and over as JP said, we're doing a little background here before this interview, is the value of empowerment and giving your players the opportunity to practice leadership. And I wonder if you could talk, first of all, just a little bit about your captain process, because oftentimes, you know, we're working with coaches and we get into this debate about, do the coaches pick the captains? Do the players pick the captains? And you have a very interesting process for that. And I wonder if you could kind of lay that out a little bit for our listeners.
Absolutely. In 2010, we actually, it was my second year at Bowden. I think talking to a lot of peer coaches, they've said, like, when you take over a program, oftentimes it's the second year where you hit some bumps in the road. The first year is sort of the honeymoon period. And then the second year you encounter, you kind of sort of settle in and encounter some difficulties with really establishing your model for success and putting your own, you know, thumbprint on the program. And so that definitely happened to me. We had a great season by all accounts with regard to wins and losses. We went to the Sweet 16 and lost to the higher seed on the road. And after that, our team kind of splintered. We had some issues with our cohesiveness and dissatisfaction with the players. And I was shocked at that. And it really blindsided me. And I think our initial reaction as coaches is often to be defensive. But once I settled in and sort of examined what had happened, talked to some peer coaches and I read actually Patrick Lencioni's book, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, which is one of my favorites. It became clear that we hadn't established trust within the program. And so I just tried to think of a lot of different ways to get at trust. And making everything that we do a lot more transparent. And the captain's process was one of the things that we decided to really transform. And so we have a hiring process. We hire our captains. Our leaders have to apply for the job. And then our players interview the applicants for the job. And they hire their leaders through a balloting process that I can get into more if you want to. But we have a job description that the team has created through the years. And I think that really, you know, is a blueprint for the women in our program to not only lead and be held accountable to the standards of leadership, but for our first years, you know, right away when they come in, they're looking at that job description and that blueprint, and it gives them sort of a map to get where they want to go. It's a clear, you know, path to being a captain if they so desire that role, which I think everyone does.
When it comes to that job description, do you recreate that every year, or you carry it over and make edits, or how does that work?
We carry over and make edits every year. That's how we start our interview process. We, you know, I make sure that I send the document out several times to the team. I ask them to be thoughtful about it, to look it over. And then before we start the interview process, every player is required to come with a question for the applicants. But before we do that, we review the job description. We ask the applicants to actually sign it, physically sign it, and commit to those standards. But, you know, as we're going through it, you know, piece by piece, you know, I think it's really powerful. And it, again, it provides accountability for those people that are serving in those roles.
When you're selecting captains, there's always a little bit of drama, I think, in some programs. And that's why I think many coaches try to avoid it. And they try to claim everybody should be a leader these days, which I know there's a lot of research out there that, no, there needs to be certain people that are appointed, which is obviously one of the, you know, the way you're doing it here. What would you say are some of the challenges that come from selecting, even in this very intentional process that you've seen over the years? I mean, has there been any challenges with this type of system that you use?
Yeah, early on, I think there were some challenges with some seniors not being hired. And the first year in particular, you know, there were some strong reactions to that. But you know, to their credit in those early years, you know, we communicated a lot with those players, and they worked through it and came to understand that they could lead without a title. And that oftentimes people are hiring captains based on leadership strengths and how people work together. So, you know, they could be a super effective leader, but there could be someone else that brings similar traits to the table that's just a little bit better or more effective than that person. And so, you know, they're not hired. Or, you know, I think early on it was a little bit challenging, but then as the younger players started to see older players role model selflessness in the face of not receiving the title, that sort of becomes the standard of understanding that we have a lot of talented leaders, but not everyone's going to get hired, and there are lots of ways to lead without the title. We do look for selfless, you know, team first type individuals when we're recruiting. And so I think we've got to a really great place where we really haven't had that many issues, you know, there's always disappointment. There's oftentimes tears, but I think our players have done an excellent job of working through that and trusting that the team is making the right decision in that moment.
Got a few things I've already learned from you on that, because we run a very similar system, or what we call the captain's council system, with a lot of the programs that we support, where it's players are elected, but they create a job description and we assign them units that these players are in charge of leading throughout the season. I'm curious, empowerment, it's a buzzword, but your players talk about how they, in some of the articles I've read, how they actually do feel that you empower them. You empower them in this process of selecting the captains. How do you empower the captains throughout the year? What are some ways that you empower them to step up and to lead?
Yeah, we meet with the captains once a week, and we talk about all aspects of the program and really lean on them to have a finger on the pulse of the team. And if there's just someone we're a little bit worried about, we ask them to really find ways to connect with their teammates and dig into that. We believe that leaders really, you know, have an awareness and about what's going on within the team and sort of recognize the negative trends before they really develop. So we rely heavily on our captains to, you know, lean into where the team's at and to go at those concerns before they develop into full-blown problems. So that's just one example. I mean, our captains have a lot of responsibility, and we really work a lot with our leaders on holding their teammates accountable, which I think is very difficult for all young people, but especially women. And so that's something that we work on a lot within our program.
Why don't you take a minute to unpack that a little bit more? Because I know that's one of the common challenges that we, you know, work with coaches on, is how do you get them to hold their peers accountable, whether it's in practice or it's off the court or it's, you know, on Friday nights or whatever it might be. Because that's not something that I think young people have an opportunity to practice, not just holding each other accountable, being held accountable, you know, by somebody who's at their same level. And so I'm curious as to how you approach that with your leaders.
Yeah, accountability is another one of our team values, as is trust. And so it's interesting. I listened to your podcast around the definition of family, and it was fascinating to me. And for me, you know, how I define family is, you know, if you're part of a family, then you should be able to have tough conversations. I mean, you know, siblings are constantly fighting about different things. And yet I see in a lot of teams, there's this fear of conflict and fear of being truly honest with your teammates. But that's what family is to me. It's having that that trust, that the relationship that you can say, you know, anything to your family member and know that the intent is always that of love. And so we try to really instill in our players a sense that high functioning teams embrace conflict. If you're not calling someone out, whether it's on the court or off for something that you feel like is not reflecting our core values, then you're doing a disservice, not only to the team, but to that individual. And so I think our players, when they come into the program, they start to develop this sense of, that if people are calling them out, it's out of love. It's out of love rather than some sort of criticism or trying to tear them down. So obviously it has to be done in the right way, but we, like I said, we work on that a lot and talk about it a lot.
Could you share with coaches what's an example of in your program where your players, your captains step up and do hold others accountable? Maybe it happened the last few years on a certain issue. What type of things are they stepping in on?
The simple thing is on the court, they're calling each other out for simple things like you didn't get to the basket line. We need you to get there and make sure that we're providing strong help in the paint. Just simple. Those are the easy things. I mean, but we even have to work on that. I think that's difficult for women coming into the program to call each other out on what I would consider to be the really simple things. I think the harder things are for our women are off the things that happen off the court. Or, you know, if there's an issue with tone on the court, or, you know, we had we've had issues with players who have had bad body language. And it's not because it is selfish, but it usually stems from being too hard on yourself, you know, and then getting in your own head if your shots aren't falling and coming to the bench and not giving other people high fives, things like that. I think it's harder for them to call teammates out for issues that go beyond the X's and O's. But those are the things that we expect them to do as they get more and more comfortable with trying things on. And we create smart goals around those types of things so that they can start practicing the behaviors. And what they find is once they start doing those behaviors and finding success, it becomes more comfortable for them.
I absolutely love that you're doing that because I think you're right. I think it's harder even for women to kind of call each other out, and not just on teams, but in the workplace. I know my wife in the workplace, just there are certain connotations or assumptions people make around women that are, you know, maybe trying to hold other people accountable that they don't have with men. And so I think it's just so important that we're working in your work with the women and developing that type of leadership style. I think that's just really, really important. One thing I wanted to ask you about is your players accuse you of over communicating, right? Is there such a thing as over communicating, and what's that look like for you?
I don't think there is such a thing. I really don't. I believe in order to have that trust, you need to be transparent. And again, I believe in, you know, going right at things before they become issues. And so, I think it's really important. I mean, we do weekly captains meetings. We have a leadership council. Everyone actually serves on the leadership council. So because we want to build that leadership from our freshmen through our senior class. So we have three groups of five, and each committee, if you want to call it that, is chaired by one of our captains or one of our leaders, senior leaders. And so they create the agendas for the meetings and run the meetings. There's a scribe and the coaches are sitting there and we're participants, but they're really driving the meetings. So we have those meetings. We have check-ins with our players every other week where we're just checking in with them and having meetings, usually around 15 to 20 minutes around academics, residential life, you know, how they're feeling about their role on the team. So, I mean, we have mentoring programs with our upper class and our lower class. I mean, there's lots of different forms of communication that we utilize, but I believe they're effective in creating that cohesiveness that we seek.
Laura, on the subject of communication, you had mentioned earlier in your first couple of years as you were building that transparency was important in building trust. And I wonder if you could share maybe some of the ways that transparency piece of communication has evolved for you over time, so that trust is, you know, a more plentiful resource for you now than maybe it was in those first couple of years.
Yeah, I'll use the example of recruiting. In our leadership council meetings, recruiting, the players always put that at the top of the agenda each and every week. They want to know, they'll ask me, they're comfortable now asking me questions like, how many recruits are you bringing in this year? What positions? Why? And they want to feel like there's a dialogue between the coaching staff and the players about who we're bringing in, the qualities that those people bring. Ideally, they're players that they've had a chance to interact with at elite clinics or, you know, on campus visits. And so they have opinions about who they want to be their teammates, and they want to be heard with that, which I very much appreciate. And I really listen in when they're talking about the recruiting process. But I think, you know, having those conversations, especially around recruiting, that just is an example of transparency that we didn't used to do that. And I think, you know, sometimes coaches assume that things are obvious when they're just really not. So one of the examples was one year they asked, you know, how many people are you bringing, what positions? And I said, well, I want to bring in a point guard. And they looked at me stunned and they said, well, we have two rising senior point guards that are phenomenal, and why would you want to bring in a third? And I just, you know, I looked at them and said, well, do you expect that someone can come into our league, which is the top league in Division III, as a point guard, as a freshman, and run this program? Don't you think that person would need a year of being mentored by our two rising seniors to really understand the role, to get up to speed with regard to her skills and her fitness level? And they were like, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so instead of those two senior point guards feeling an angst about I'm recruiting over them, or, you know, they understood exactly where we were coming from. And then they were amazing mentors for the freshman that we ended up bringing in, who's actually graduating this year. She's a phenomenal point guard. So that's just one example.
Oh, that's a great example. And I think one of the things is I have conversation with coaches about just the issue of transparency and communication and really honesty. You know, when you're asking, when players are asking you, who are you going to bring in? And you say a point guard, and all of a sudden there's this fear and there's disappointment and there's like, what is she doing? I think as coaches, we're afraid of that sometimes, you know, to have to interact in that crucial or difficult conversation. And I think one of the things that I've been going round and round with coaches on recently is having these conversations over roles and playing time, knowing that a player is likely going to be disappointed, you know, if they have an ambition to be a starter in the rotation. And as we get into the year, it's clear that they're not in that place. And I wonder, you know, you value vulnerability and empowerment and communication. How do you try to coach through those situations where you know your players are going to be disappointed, either how the rotation is shaken out or by some of the decisions that you've had to make as a coach?
Well, we try to have those discussions early about roles and what our expectations are looking like early in the season. And one of the things that we do, you know, I think a lot of us have individual meetings with our team or teammates like preseason to talk about roles. And I've gotten away from that because I feel as though peer feedback is really critical for our players and developing trust and transparency. And so we do a lot of meetings in peer groups, so positional groups. So we have our little guards in a meeting and our kind of swing players and then our posts in a meeting. And this is, you know, usually the first week of practice, and we'll go on and say, what are your expectations with regard to playing time? And we ask them to actually circle a number. So they have to say, I expect 20 minutes a game in front of their peers. And it leads to just like rich conversations with their peers around what they need to work on or what they're seeing. But it also, when they're circling a number, it allows us to go back, you know, add up all those numbers and say, you know, you guys, you know, have like indicated that there are 1,000 minutes of playing time that just don't exist, you know, and you have to be thinking about the bigger picture as we coaches are. And so I don't know, I think that question has really served us well. And it's allowed us to, from the beginning, have a sense of what I'm seeing and what they're seeing is not lining up. So we bring those individuals in right away and then have a follow-up meeting about, you know, you're saying you expect 20 minutes, but you're playing the same position as our All-American, you know, National Player of the Year candidate. So is that really realistic? And we have those conversations. And again, oftentimes they're hard, but I think that level of communication can really offset issues down the road, so that when you're getting in games, they're sort of having an understanding of what to expect, but also how to work to gain more of a role, because they all want that.
I absolutely love that. We do some stuff with coaches where we've used Google Forms, but they're communicating to the coach how many minutes they expect and what they think their role is. But I love how you're incorporating the conversation, not just between you and the player, but between them and the people they're competing for playing time. I think that's really, really valuable. Have you felt players struggle to engage in that type of activity at the beginning of the season, and some hesitancy on their part?
Yes, for sure. I think now they know the question's coming. And so I think they've learned, especially as they come in as freshmen, you know, often they're looking around and they're like, well, I circled 0 to 5 minutes because I don't really know and I don't know what to expect. But then they see our seniors saying, I circled, you know, 10 to 15 minutes because I know I'm playing with these first team all conference players, but I want my role to be that person that can be sixth man and get off the bench and provide a spark for the team. And they're seeing the older players, you know, role model that thoughtfulness. And so, you know, there are times too where freshmen will come in and circle a high number, not often in our program, but again, I think that provides for some great conversations to start things off, but it also provides for accountability. If someone circles 10 to 15 and that's what they're getting, and then they're knocking on your door saying, I deserve more, You can look back and say, well, you, this is what you said. And where's the disconnect now? Because this is what you said you were going to get before the season. But why are you dissatisfied now? And let's talk about that. And really in those moments, I used to, as a young coach, get pretty defensive. And I've learned that that is just really a relationship crusher, is when you respond to student athletes' voices with defensiveness.
I think one of the things that's powerful about that process too is that players, you know, and when they become adults, obviously are going to encounter disappointment in life, right? I just had this conversation with a coach yesterday that, you know, when we choose to apply for a job, we're excited about the possibility of getting it, but we also enter into this place of vulnerability where there's also four other candidates and there's a chance that we may not get it. And that's life, right? And we have to be able to deal with, you know, those disappointments. I think so many of us are experiencing that, you know, even now in the midst of the pandemic. Like, nobody wants to be in this situation. We certainly don't want to be trapped with our children at home, you know, until September or beyond. And yet here we are. And so what you're modeling here is a way through some of those natural human emotions and a way to teach young women how to communicate through those things together. And I think that's an amazing example.
Yeah. And you use the word vulnerability. We talk a lot about that, especially recently. We just did our captain's process actually over Zoom this year, which was, I was concerned it was going to be not at all as effective as, you know, sitting in a room together. It wasn't bad actually. But one of the things that came up a lot for this leadership team that we're going to be our 2021 sort of leaders, is that they need to work on that, the vulnerability. I think our current seniors did such a nice job of showing those moments. And we were, as coaches, sure to point that out and say, see how being vulnerable and putting yourself out there in that way can really increase your followership. So I don't know. I think that vulnerability is really important in being an effective leader, for sure.
I got two more questions before we let you get out of here. One is around recruiting, because you've mentioned it on two different occasions, how you're very intentional at making sure you recruit the type of player that fits your values. And my initial question really was, okay, how do you identify the players out there that meet your values on the recruiting process? And you've already shared a little bit. Apparently, your current players have some influence and have some say, I guess, on who you recruit. So I thought you could maybe share a little bit more on how you make sure that the people are the right fit for your culture.
Yeah, we, like I said, we're really clear about our team values. Our players know them. For a while, we got to the point where we had so many team values. I don't know if you've read The Messiah Method or, but I was obsessed with that book several years ago. And I got to the point where we had 10 or 12 team values, but in a sort of a defining moment, we were doing our captain's process and one of the teammates asked the applicants, you know, which team value do you represent the most, and provide an example. And our captains couldn't answer the question. They couldn't remember our team values because we had so many and it was incredibly watered down. And so we worked about 3 or 4 years ago on really getting our team values to the core essential four. And so, you know, the players, recruits and their parents, sometimes the savvy ones will come in and ask, what are your team values? And our players, I think it's really powerful when your players can articulate those and they know and embrace them. And so we look, like I said, for recruits who really value the things that we value. And I think, you know, when you go out and watch recruits play, for me, it's a lot about body language. It's about effort. It's about being a good teammate. We look for those things a lot. And we will pass on talent if we feel like that person isn't a good teammate. Things like rolling your eyes at your parents or your coach, they're deal breakers for me, because I think they show a lack of respect. And if you don't respect your high school coach or your parent, then I feel like it's going to be incredibly hard for me to develop that level of trust, which is one of our team values, with a student. You know, we look for people who want to be great teammates, who are selfless and hardworking. Those are really the main qualities. It's sometimes not easy to define, but I don't know. We know it when we see it. That makes sense.
No, I love that. And you gave some examples of you know what it doesn't look like. And I think sometimes that's what coaches need to take that more of approach, is looking for those little behaviors that are signs of something that's bigger and deeper.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's a really important piece. I was reading an article and it just blew me away what one of your players said. They said that everyone probably thinks they are your favorite, which is probably the opposite of every other coach in the country, where their players are accusing them of having, they've got the special favorite here and there, you know, not feeling like they're the favorite. But here, everyone feels they're the favorite. How the heck do you manage that?
I think it's just about taking the time to really, get to know student athletes and making them feel like they're valued, because we do value them. And back to vulnerability, I try to be vulnerable with them and encourage them to be so with me. I think the deepest relationships I've had with student athletes have come from events in their lives that have forced them to be vulnerable with me, deaths of parents and terrible things like that. Ideally, like, student athletes aren't dealing with those things, but if I can get them to a point where they trust me and they can talk to me about what's really going on in their lives, you know, off the court, I think that's where the magic really happens, in building relationships and trust with students.
Well, we appreciate you coming on the podcast here, and I'm going to get you out of here with this. One of the things that your players also described about their experience there is kind of this balance between everything in practice is competitive, and yet we walk off the court feeling like we're best friends. And I know that's another thing that coaches sometimes struggle. You know, we want a competitive environment. We want them going hard at each other. We want them competing for time and minutes and roles. And yet we still expect and hope that they're going to be great teammates, you know, when the whistle blows or the horn goes off. So how do you teach that, or how do you walk your players through that process of valuing both the competitive aspect of the sport and the relationship piece that's so important for teammates to be able to build?
Yeah, again, passion to compete is one of our team values. And we try to establish a feeling in our program where if you're not giving it your all, like, we're going to be super disappointed with that. I'm constantly impressed by my players and how, when we do have recruits come in, or, you know, we have a clinic, they're pointing at the best talent, saying, you know, our point guard is pointing at the best point guard on the floor, saying, I want to play with her. I want to go up against her every day. And we try to create that sort of environment where they understand if they're not going up against the best every day, then, you know, that's not doing them any good. You know, it's a disservice to them and their potential as a student athlete. And so we just try to celebrate those moments where they're going hard with one another. And I think that just creates a sense of, we're all trying to make each other better. So when you walk off the lines, there's a real sense of gratitude about, you know, we can battle, but we're doing that to make one another better, and we're all in this together. There are times we have to remind them in practice, like, you do remember you're all on the same team, because they are incredibly competitive and things can get heated. And I think that's okay. I think that's great. As long as it doesn't cross a huge line, I think that's exactly what you want. Because you're going to see those moments in the heat of battle against another team. And so that level of competitiveness is going to serve you well in those moments.
Thanks so much to Coach Scheibels for coming on the podcast today. There's so much great stuff in there. You can check her out on Twitter at Coach Scheibels, or send her an email. It's in the details of this episode. If you like what you heard in today's episode and you want to successfully implement your captain's council or your leadership council this season, you are in luck, because I just released another training course on coachtube.com for the captain's council system. The course walks you through step by step each phase to properly implement and then run the system throughout the season. I've built this system off my experience of helping over 50 coaches implement at the youth, high school, collegiate, and professional level. Every coach who has implemented this has not only continued to run it the next season, but they add more and more to it because it works. Players develop as leaders. It builds a more cohesive and connected team, and it also creates that player-led culture that we crave. Click on the link in the details of this episode and don't miss out on this exclusive discount and this opportunity to transform your culture today.